got a sprain or an itch, pain that's swelling or twitch, call up and ask me, Dr. Lasky. Dr. Lasky.
Welcome to another edition of Hey Doc. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center, right here in Jacksonville, Florida. I'm your host for the next half hour. With me today is my co-host and wife, Carmen Lasky, a certified EMT. Together, we hope that you will find the show informative, educational, as well as entertaining.
The definition of a myth is, well, to put it in as few words as possible, an untrue belief. Now, that may be a bit simplistic, as there are four basic theories and three types of myths. The theories all have specific names, those being rational, functional, structural, and psychological myth theories. Now, the rational myth theory states that myths were created to express natural events and forces. But there are also types of myths, and these include etiological, historical, and psychological myths. The etiological type includes those that were created to attempt to explain the reason why something is the way it is today.
Historical myths, on the other hand, are told about an historical event and are basically created to help keep the memory of that event alive.
And then there's the psychological myth, which tries to explain why we feel and act the way we do. The word etiological comes from a Greek word meaning reason or explanation. But in order for it to be a myth, the reasons given for the myth are not the real or scientific reasons. They are simply explanations that have meaning for us as human beings. Now, these myths include natural, etymological, and religious. So what is a natural etiological myth?
It could be an attempt to explain an aspect of nature, such as explaining lightning and thunder, by saying that the god Zeus is angry.
The etiological subtype may help to explain the origin of words, as in the attempt to explain the name of the goddess Aphrodite, by saying that she was born in seafoam, since Aphros is the Greek word for seafoam. And finally, a religious etiological myth explains the origin of a religious ritual.
For example, you could explain the Greek religious ritual of the Eleusinian Mysteries by saying that they originated when the Greek goddess Demeter, who came down to the city of Eleusis and thought that people had to worship her.
The main thing here is that all three of these explanations are simply not true. Zeus's anger is not the correct explanation for lightning and thunder. Aphrodite's name was not actually derived from the Greek word Aphros. And Demeter did not establish his own religious rituals in the town of Eleusis. Historical myths, on the other hand, are often created simply to keep the memory of that specific person or event alive.
Ironically, in historical myths, the accuracy is lost, but meaning is gained. The myths about the Trojan War, including the Iliad and the Odyssey, could be classified as historical myths.
The Trojan War did occur, but the famous characters that we know from the Iliad and Odyssey, such as Achilles, probably did not exist. And finally, the psychological myth, which is different from an etiological myth because a psychological myth does not try to explain one thing by way of something else, but the emotion itself is seen as a divine force coming from the outside that can directly influence a person's emotions.
Getting back to the goddess Aphrodite, she's sometimes seen as the power of erotic love. When someone said or did something that they did not want to do, they, ancient Greeks, might say that Aphrodite made them do it.
So why did we start this show with the topic of myths? Well, that's because we wanted to talk to you about chocolate.
My mom always said life was like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're gonna get.
It's tempting to swallow the hype about chocolate's supposed benefits. Now let's look at the myths and really separate them from the facts. So let's start with something most of us have recently heard, and that is that chocolate is good for you.
Well, there is some fact here, as cocoa beans, which are the main ingredient in chocolate, contain naturally occurring polyphenols. And we do know that there is at least some evidence that polyphenols help reduce blood pressure and have antioxidant properties.
But hold your hats here. A study published just about a year ago from the Baylor College of Medicine in Texas has suggested that chocolate can keep the heart's blood vessels healthy. However, this study did not consider the types of chocolate, the amount of chocolate, what else the participants were eating, or the risk factors for heart and circulatory diseases that people might have had.
So, at least in most people's eyes, this was not a very definitive study, and its value was questioned.
The problem here is multifold. I always say that you must weigh the benefits of any action with its risks. Remember that chocolate is high in sugar and saturated fat. It's thought of as a high-energy food, meaning high-calorie food. And too much can result in excessive weight, which ends up being a risk factor for cardiovascular disease.
If you are looking for healthier sources of polyphenols, then look at beans, various fruits, and some vegetables.
There's another saying that chocolate gives you energy. Now, chocolate does contain small amounts of caffeine, which may contribute to the idea that it makes us energetic. But when you're hungry, it's better to eat a snack that provides sustained energy release. It's probably one of those reasons that when I say I'm hungry, Carmen just puts a fruit like a orange or tangerine in front of me.
And you really need to choose foods with less sugar and fat and with more fiber, such as a small sandwich, a piece of toast, an apple, or a small bowl of unsweetened cereal.
You may also have heard that dark chocolate's better for you. Now, it does contain more cocoa solids and cocoa butter than milk chocolate, but the amount of polyphenols depends on how the chocolate's processed. So it's not necessarily better. During the manufacturing process, which includes cleaning, fermentation, roasting time, and temperature, as well as a process called dutching, which is simply alkalizing the chocolate, and the addition of extra ingredients to the chocolate, such as emulsifiers and sugar, for example, the polyphenols are often almost completely removed from the dark chocolate.
We have even heard the myth that a chocolate bar is the perfect portion. However, any excess energy you consume with the chocolate will lead to weight gain.
One chocolate bar averages 250 calories. Now, that's equivalent to about 10% of a man's and 12% of a woman's recommended daily intake. And it's often gobbled down in a few minutes.
So, if you are trying to lose weight, then you would need to walk about 50 minutes, that is over 3/4 of an hour, just to lose the energy obtained from a chocolate bar.
Another myth is that chocolate is addictive, but there's really no evidence that chocolate causes any physical addiction. What happens is that our feelings about chocolate tend to dictate our behavior, as we associate it with comfort, reward, and celebration.
This connection means we might feel that we need it, which can make it harder to control how much we eat.
Now, I know we've also heard that hot chocolate doesn't count. Well, one thing that is true is that cocoa powder used to make hot chocolate contains less fat because it doesn't include the cocoa butter and other fats that are found in chocolate bars.
But the problem here lies in what is added to the cocoa powder and what you add to the drink to make it palatable.
Depending on what you mix the chocolate powder with, your hot chocolate drink can contain as many calories, fats, and sugar as between 1 and 2.5 average chocolate bars. That would mean walking it off for about 1.5 hours. Now, many diabetics also think that they cannot eat chocolate, but that's not entirely true.
Most people who have diabetes can usually consume chocolate in moderation and as part of a healthy lifestyle and diet. There is usually no need for special diabetic chocolate products that are often higher in energy and fat and may still raise your blood glucose levels.
How about eating chocolate with bubbles in it? You know, adding air makes it less dense than solid chocolate. So eating chocolate with bubbles can be like eating a slightly smaller bar. And therefore, you are getting less fat, saturated fat, and sugar per portion.
Always check the portion size, because some bubbly chocolates are sold in large bars than your usual solid chocolate bar, eliminating any health benefits.
Walking in the supermarket cereal aisle is visually similar to walking in the same aisle 60 years ago. The cereal boxes, for example, do not look any different than they did then, at least in size. But that's deceiving, since the front of the box is the same, but the thickness of the box has decreased. Now, this allows the manufacturers to decrease the amount of cereal in each box without making the box look perceptibly different to the purchasers in the supermarkets. That's a good ploy. But enough on chocolate. It's getting the both of us here pretty hungry.
This is a great time to tell you about Southside Medical Center. Hello, I'm Dr. Harold Lasky. I have been the medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center for the past 34 years. We're located at 3604 Southside Boulevard, just two blocks south of the Beach Boulevard intersection between the Tulsa Welding School and the old Pottsburg Post Office.
We will treat your pains, sprains, and strains.
We are proud to welcome to Southside Medical Center Dr. Susan Pollan, MD, a board-certified pain specialist.
Our practice emphasizes chronic pain management as well as anti-aging medicine. We also have an office-based substance treatment program for those who need it. Southside Medical Center is open 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. If you would like to make an appointment or ask any questions about Southside Medical Center, please call us at 641-4411. That's 641-4411. Southside Medical Center, where your health is our primary care.
Welcome back to the Hey Doc Show.
Are you planning to visit Japan this summer? After all, the Summer Olympics starts in just over 1 month on July 23rd.
There are some Tokyo doctors who still are reportedly calling for the Olympic Games to be canceled, and many Japanese have pretty much soured on the event. It's important to understand that just over 4% of people in Japan have been fully vaccinated against COVID-19. Now, that's in contrast to the United States, that as of 6 a.m. on June 8th, a total of over 140 million Americans had been successfully vaccinated, or that's, well, about 42.3% of the country's population.
There are still several major Japanese cities that are still under a state of emergency due to COVID-19.
The country also has about 40,000 active coronavirus cases, although the case numbers have been dropping since mid-May. Right now, though, all signs point to the Olympics going ahead as scheduled.
The International Olympic Committee has released a series of playbooks detailing how athletes, support staff, and others will be protected from COVID-19 during the Games.
But Dr. Annie K. Sparrow, who's the Assistant Professor of Population Health Science and Policy at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York City, has several things saying that she thinks that these measures will fall short. According to her, the IOC's playbooks are not built on scientifically rigorous risk assessments, and they fail to consider the ways in which coronavirus exposure occurs, the factors that contribute to exposure, and which participants may be at highest risk.
One of the quote protective measures outlined in the playbooks is that athletes are encouraged to get vaccinated.
Now, you probably heard right, encouraged. It is not going to be mandatory. And there will be many visitors to Japan for the Olympics from many low and middle income countries where there is a short supply of vaccines.
This means that many of the visitors that you would be in contact with while attending the Games and even walking around the city would not be vaccinated either. This could put visitors at risk and possibly others at risk later when the tourists return to the U.S.
Since we're getting pretty close to the date of the Games, many athletes are really starting to worry about the side effects of vaccination on their performance. Remember that it takes time for your body to build protection from any vaccination. People are considered fully vaccinated about 2 weeks after their second shot of the Pfizer, BioNTech, or Moderna COVID-19 vaccines, and 2 weeks after the single dose of the J&J Janssen COVID-19 vaccine. 2 weeks. That means that anyone who delays taking the vaccine to the 2 weeks prior to the Games could still be susceptible to getting COVID-19.
The IOC playbook calls for athletes to have regular temperature checks and monitor in themselves for symptoms.
So theoretically, any athlete with symptoms will be required to undergo PCR testing. Still, just monitoring for symptoms will most likely miss a lot of coronavirus cases.
Also remember that because people with COVID-19 can be infectious 48 hours before they develop symptoms and may not even develop symptoms at all. Routine temperatures and symptom screening will not be effective for identifying pre-symptomatic or asymptomatic people.
It could be helped if they use the strategies that were used by the National Football League and the Major League Baseball teams here in the United States by performing daily PCR testing. Now, the Olympic Committee's playbook says that, quote, in principle, athletes will be tested daily whether or not they have symptoms.
But in addition to daily testing, the NFL used other, including strict masks requirements and identifying high-risk contact through contact tracing.
Interestingly, Olympic Committee plans are giving every athlete a smartphone with a contact tracing app. Now, this could work, but many are suspicious of this simply because, well, those contact tracing apps are often ineffective. The committee has to classify certain events as low, moderate, or high risk, depending on the activity and the venue. For example, events like sailing and equestrian events would really be low risk because athletes are outside and physically distanced from each other.
Other sports that involve close contact, such as soccer or rugby, would be medium risk, while indoor events would carry a high risk because of the decreased ventilation when inside.
This holds even for individual sports like gymnastics. But it's not just during the games. How about the filled hotels, as well as buses, stadiums, and cafeterias, which all carry a higher risk than an outdoor area? Remember that during these events, hotel rooms are often shared by three athletes, putting them at higher risk. So what happens if an athlete tests positive? Will the others that shared the room with the athlete need to be quarantined?
We have been talking just about the Olympic Games. Just 1 month later are the Paralympic Games, which are set to start on August 24th.
Now, this event carries its own risks, especially if there is an uptick of community transmission following the Olympic Games. Some of the Paralympic athletes are really in a higher risk category for COVID-19.
So if you decide to go, you may like to bring back some souvenirs for your friends and family. Just make sure that you don't bring home the virus.
On one of our recent shows, we mentioned that there's a new drug that has been approved for the treatment of Alzheimer's disease. But we just did not have the time to really look at that drug and talk about its pros and cons. Now, we'll most likely not be able to get to the disease itself, so that will be left for one of next shows that we have. As we said, on the previous show, there has been a hiatus of about 20 years, or as Abraham Lincoln might have said, one score years ago. There has been no new treatment for Alzheimer's disease.
Then along came Biogen, who received an accelerated approval for aducanumab under the trade name Aduhelm. This drug works by attacking the protein plaques in the brain that are associated with Alzheimer's disease.
The clinical trials confirm that the drug slows disease progression in its early stages by helping clear plaque associated with the disease. It certainly does clear the plaque, but it does not clearly show that it improves the symptoms. Kind of like the old saying, the surgery was a success. Unfortunately, the patient died.
So, the clinical trials actually did slow the progression of plaques associated with Alzheimer's, at least in patients with early stages of the disease.
It is known that in Alzheimer's disease, nerve cell death is due to the deposit of what are called amyloid plaques and neurofibrillary tangles in the brain, and that eventually leads to the clinical dysfunctions. And according to Dr. Gayatri Devi, a similar process can occur with other forms of dementia, not just Alzheimer's disease. For example, in Lewy body disease, which is a common form of dementia, remember the actor Robin Williams, whose suicide was linked to this diagnosis of Lewy body dementia? There is data that shows that removing or preventing plaques can actually help in Alzheimer's disease.
That said, Alzheimer's disease is a devastating illness that can have a profound impact on the lives of people diagnosed with the disease, as well as their loved ones.
While currently available therapies only treat the symptoms of Alzheimer's, Aduhelm is the first treatment to target and affect the underlying disease process of Alzheimer's. According to the FDA, this is the first new treatment approved for Alzheimer's since 2003.
But because of the symptom relief controversy, the FDA has apparently asked the Biogen now start another trial to verify that the drug actually works. If the trial fails, the FDA could revoke approval.
According to the new treatment label, this drug is administered by injection as an intravenous infusion for about 1 hour every 4 weeks.
Patients are warned that they might experience side effects such as cerebral edema, meaning swelling of the brain, bleeding from the brain, angioedema, or swelling beneath the skin, itching, falling diarrhea, and disorientation.
It's also not a cheap drug, costing about $4,600 a month or $56,000 per year. However, biotech company has vowed not to increase the price of the medication for the next 4 years. Small consolation, especially for a drug that may not stop any symptoms.
Then there are the phase 4 confirmatory trials, which are intended to verify that treatment has a clinical benefit. Failing to show efficacy in this trial could result in the FDA rescinding their decision.
Also remember that this drug would not be the only medication Alzheimer's patients would need to take. So what's the bottom line here? After nearly 20 years without new treatments, Biogen has won accelerated approval for Aduhelm, the brand name for aducanumab, a drug that treats Alzheimer's by attacking the protein plaques associated with this disease, which may or may not improve symptoms of those with Alzheimer's disease. And for our final topic today, to end the show, we'd like to make an addendum to one of our previous shows concerning sunscreens.
Researchers have said that they found 27% of sunscreen samples tested contained benzene, and some batches had up to 3 times the conditionally restricted concentration limit of 2 parts per million allowed by the Food and Drug Administration, or FDA.
Remember that the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, benzene is a carcinogen, and it lists inhalation, skin absorption, ingestion, and just even skin and eye contact as possible exposure routes. Now, if you're interested in getting the list of those sunscreens that contain benzene and those that are mentioned in the FDA's document, you can give us a call at the clinic. Southside Medical Center's number is 641-4411. Now, there appear to be well over 50, maybe closer to 70, benzene-containing sunscreens in that list.
Remember that not all sunscreen products contain benzene, and that uncontaminated products are available. These should continue to be used and are necessary to be included in your armamentarium to protect against potentially harmful solar radiation.
These reports have often scared potential customers, and many have been drawn to making their own sunscreens. So you might be saying, hey, what about the DIY do-it-yourself sunscreens? With news of benzene coming from brands such as Banana Boat and CVS, you might be wondering if it's safer to simply make your own. Well, the experts are really against this for a variety of reasons. The first is that most homemade sunscreens simply lack effective sun protection, leaving users vulnerable to sunburn, premature skin aging, and obviously skin cancer.
And it goes without saying that homemade sunscreens do not go through the rigorous testing required of commercial sunscreens by the FDA, which means that their SPF, water resistance, and shelf life cannot be guaranteed.
So our best suggestion is to use sunscreens as we have always recommended. But maybe you should look at that list and stay away from those sunscreens that contain benzene. After all, there are plenty that don't contain this suspicious chemical.
Yo solo sé que nació pa' mí, me ha robado el corazón.
I'd like you, our listeners, to know that I am one of several physicians right here in the Jacksonville area that has received the certification to recommend medical marijuana to those patients with certain qualifying diagnoses. For more information, you can call our office at 641-4411. We have also set up a special website at CompassionateCareJax.com, where you can get a whole lot more information on medical marijuana.
We've come to the end of another Hey Doc show.
So, from all of us here at Southside Medical Center, have a happy and healthy weekend. Goodbye.